Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Thank you, Patty. I'm Dave Cohen. Now Tommy Tucker's got one more story here on WWL.
Yeah, it's from our website at WWL.com about, and you may have just mentioned it, about being able to take a picture with the championship trophy.
I did not mention that.
It's on our website, WWL.com. You should take a look, Dave.
I've seen it. I just didn't mention it.
You can head to, in Baton Rouge, both of them, Rouse's Wednesday between 4 and 7, or they got a Walmart you can go to from 4 until 7. That's all today. And
when you said Wednesday, I was like, oh, wait, what? Today is Wednesday. The week is flying by.
But you know what it is? It's a game on Monday night that did that.
Yes, very confusing.
Yeah. So anyway, I don't know if – would you want a picture of yourself with the trophy?
I have a picture of myself with the Super Bowl trophy.
Yeah.
From when the Saints won.
Mm-hmm.
Bobby Hebert somehow ended up with it at a post-Mardi Gras parade event. And so I said, oh, Bobby's got the trophy. So I went and took a picture with it. But I don't know if I'd go out of my way to go somewhere to take a picture with it.
Bobby Hebert had the Super Bowl trophy?
Yeah. He somehow ended up, it was a decade ago, the Saints had won the Super Bowl. And it was at the Orphy Escapade. And there was a state trooper who was kind of keeping an eye on it. But I think Sean Payton brought it to the Orphy Escapade. And then Bobby wanted to take a picture with it, and so he went over and did that, and he was holding it. And then other people kept walking up to him and wanting to grab it and take a picture with it. And it was kind of funny. It was a kind of a trophy free for all.
Yeah, there's your story. Not taking a picture.
I'm presuming nobody took it. There was a state trooper who was assigned to keep an eye on it.
I'm presuming there may have been some alcohol involved.
It was at the Orpheus Ball.
Thank you, Dave. Clint Wilson joins us now, professor of civil and environmental engineering, director of the LSU Center for River Studies. And we want to have him on because, you know, the whole focus has been on LSU about football. But in case you didn't realize it, there is a university involved as well. Good morning, Clint. How are you?
Hey, good morning, Tommy. Great. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for taking the time. Tell me about this model that you built about the Mississippi Delta and why you did it and how it works.
Well, sure. So, we started working with, back then, the Department of Natural Resources, back in about 2002, 2003, working on kind of using physical models to help, you know, research, help plan, help better understand the river and the way it works and the way the sediment, the sand particularly, moves down the river. And so we did that for several years, and I think this then DNR turned into CPRA, and, we started thinking about what could we do bigger, better, in terms of research, in terms of education outreach. So, you know, CPRA was able to find some funding to build a new building and build, design, and build a much, much better model and add a lot of education outreach parts to it. So, we opened up 2 years ago, January 2018, the goal of the model really is for us to help the state better understand how, you know, the river, the way the river behaves, and really the way sand moves down the river.
So how do you know that what you're doing, and I'm not trying to challenge you at all, Professor, I'm just trying to wonder, trying to figure out, how do you know that what you run, the models you run, are accurate? Because that's what you're doing, right? To see if you have a diversion here or there, what would occur?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, there's certain principles in kind of civil engineering or hydraulics or river engineering that we use to design the model. So, you know, before we ever, you know, started, you know, building the model, building the facility, et cetera, you know, we went through a pretty rigorous process, including a lot of external science and engineering panelists or reviewers to help us make sure that what we were first off proposing and wanting to build, you know, was technically sound. And then we had a great group of contractors who figure out how to build the model to the specifications that we needed, that would provide the, you know, the ability to really replicate, reproduce what happens in the Mississippi River. And then we spent a pretty good time, probably about a year, year and a half, between, you know, experiments in the flumes we have on campus and actually with the physical model, you know, demonstrating through experiments, you know, calibration and validation of the physical model itself, showing that it reproduces the way, you know, the flow rates in the river, it reproduces the water levels in the river, you know, matching up with what the Corps of Engineers and United States Geological Survey, what they measure out in the river. And we also, you know, compare the results we get to, you know, what the Corps of Engineers and the navigation industry, what they determine are the dredging rates, for example, in the lower river. So we've gone through a pretty rigorous, you know, calibration validation process to really show, you know, both the public and the scientific community that this model reproduces the way the river behaves in the lower, you know, roughly 190 miles from Donaldsonville to the Gulf.
Is it in some way, maybe adjustable is not the right word, but can you do some kind of modeling about this diversion would cause this, that one causes that, et cetera?
You know, exactly. So that's really the plan. And so, you know, we've already done two kind of 50-year into the future, as we call them, no project scenarios, where we are looking at, you know, the way that we expect the river to behave in terms of the flow rates, the water levels, and the way sand is moving down the river, you know, for over the next 50 years without any diversion projects. And so we've done those, you know, we're currently analyzing a lot of that data, making sure the model, you know, reproducibility is within the tolerances we want, comparing it to, you know, what data that's been collected by, you know, people, researchers who go out in the river and make measurements, and also to, you know, like I said before, with the core measures in terms of dredging, we also compare it to numerical models. So, yeah, so to kind of answer your question, then, so the next step is then to operate that same 50-year kind of future conditions, but put mid-Barataria sediment diversion into the model. And so we'll run the same flows, the same amount of sediment, we'll inject the same amount of model sediment, we'll have the same conditions as far as relative sea level rise, but this time we will operate the Mid-Barataria River sediment diversion, and then what we can do is we can, in essence, compare, well, here's the 50-year without the diversion, here's the 50-year with the diversion, and then we'll just keep doing that, right? And the next one will be maybe Mid-Breton sediment diversion, and then we'll do the 50 years with maybe both and start to help, you know, the state figure out how you might operate both of those river sediment diversions to really make sure, you know, you're not starve feeding one, starving the other, but really optimize the way they can be operated and used.
I'd like to go back, if we can, because you mentioned the different diversions. You know, I mean, this may be too simplistic, but a lot of people know of it. They don't know about it. So River Diversion 101, had we not built levees, had they not discovered this city or built it, discovered the area, built the city 300-something years ago, what would it look like? What would the area look like?
Yeah, without the levees that were built, you know, in order to keep people from flooding and, you know, to reduce the risk of people from flooding and to maintain the navigation route, you know, I think we would have a lot of areas, you know, New Orleans and South particularly, that would continuously would flood periodically, whether that be once a year or maybe once every couple years. You know, historically, you know, that happened. And, you know, there's a lot of papers, there's a lot of great work by, you know, geographers and historians in terms of the way the river used to, when it would, you know, start to reach flood stage, we'd get high, it would spill out over its banks, or it would kind of break through its natural banks, what geologists would call crevassing, and would deliver water sediment, you know, out into those areas. So, yeah, I think we'd have a much different landscape, you know, but one that would not be, you know, would be much, 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 much more of a challenge, right, in terms of communities living along there, along the river and navigation.
And I just wanted to ask you that to say, okay, to tell a story a little bit, Professor, if we can. So then we built levees, right? And as a result of that, what effect did it have on the coastline and erosion, et cetera?
Well, yes. So that's exactly right. So, you know, like I said, historically, you know, for the past hundreds, thousands of years, the Mississippi River, you know, our coastal wetlands, particularly, you know, kind of from that Atchafalaya River over to, you know, with the Chandelier Islands, et cetera, you know, those areas were used to getting river water, sediment, you know, from the Mississippi River, if not continually on a periodic basis when the river would flood. And because we levied those rivers, because we levied the river, right, and now we've got it kind of fixed in place, you know, those areas are now have been starved over the last, you know, you could say 80 to 100, 150, 200 years from getting river water, from getting the sediments that they used to get. And so what we've got is, you know, a disconnect of the river from the wetlands, and then you add to that the natural subsidence, you know, that sinking of the land that occurs in all deltas around the world. You get the and, you know, not just the Mississippi River, but around the world. But then you also get, you know, the saltwater intrusion that's occurring because of the subsidence and our kind of altering the hydrology. So, yeah, what we're trying to do is really help the state figure out how to reconnect the river to the wetlands.
I will pick it up here when we come back. If you have any questions or comments about diversions, et cetera, and we'll talk about the process moving forward and what kind of results we can expect when we come back. You can text your questions to 870-870. We're talking to Clint Wilson, professor of civil and environmental engineering and director of the LSU Center for River Studies, a part of this, too. And you can believe, for whatever reason, why it happens is rising sea levels. And I don't think there's anything that you can really contradict that with and say that that's not really happening. Here's an update, however, from CBS on WWL. It is 9:25 here at WWL. Tommy Tucker talking to Clint Wilson, a professor of civil and environmental engineering and director of the LSU Center for River Studies, about diversions, which is basically, I guess, Professor, diverting the river, right, from the course it's on now?
Well, that's correct, yeah. So, not diverting the river from its course, but reconnecting the river to the wetlands. So I think when you look at the state's coastal master plan, you know, they have a number of different restoration strategies, and at least two of those, whether it's the river sediment diversions or the dredging and pumping for marsh creation, both of those rely upon us understanding how kind of the river behaves in the way sand moves down the river. So that whether, you know, the state, you know, river sediment diversions are going to be open and allow some of the river water and that sand to get back out in the wetlands, or whether, you know, they're talking about, you know, projects that would dredge sand from the river and be pumped over into those wetlands. You know, we really need to have a better understanding about how that sand moves down, where it's going to be, you know, how fast does it get replenished if we use it, so that we can be thinking about the best ways to operate them. So, yeah, that's right. I think both diversions, and I think, you know, the state has a good bit of money and plans to, you know, dredge and pump that sand for marsh creation.
I always say science and politics make for strange bedfellows, but in this, it's almost science and economic interests that are at odds, right? There is some controversy involved in terms of diversion projects.
Well, that's correct. Yes, I think, you know, you have to understand that, or I think it's best to kind of think historically the way, you know, as we levied the river, as we increased the levees, you know, strengthened them, we cut off the river from those wetlands, cut off the wetlands from the river, you know, conditions, and you add subsidence, you know, the sinking of the land, you add the saltwater intrusion, you know, the system has been changing, you know, in terms of fisheries, in terms of, you know, risk to communities in those areas and in the coastal areas. So we think about that kind of historically changing. And now what we're looking at is the state's looking at, you know, to implement several projects that are going to have a, you know, a fairly strong impact on at least some regions along the river. And so, you know, I think what you're looking at is this, you know, balance, or this you know, contradictory, that's the wrong word to use. Mm-hmm. You're looking
competing.
At, you know, these interests, competing interests,
yeah,
in terms of changing the way, you know, the system is currently behaving in terms of, you know, the type of fish, where you catch them, oyster beds, et cetera, with, you know, wanting to kind of reconnect, again, wanting to reconnect the river to the wetlands and build land out over time. Maintain land, I should say.
Be it oyster fishermen or anyone, I find it hard to believe that anybody would be altruistic enough to say, I'm going to forsake my economic interests in terms of rebuilding the coast or trying to, trying this diversion. Would that be accurate? Have you found anybody that's willing so far not to contest it and say, you know what? Yeah, absolutely. Let's do it.
Well, no, I think everyone, you know, everyone comes at this from the, well, I shouldn't say everybody, but, you know, a number of people are coming at this from, you know, what the way their current economic interest, their current, you know, the way they, you know, support, feed their families, et cetera, right? So, you know, you have to understand that. And I think the state and a lot of the NGOs have gone, you know, and tried to, you know, make sure that those interests and the impacts on those communities are taken into account. And so, you know, I think there are some people that understand that, you know, there's going to be a large impact on them. And I think sometimes, you know, a way to get at that a little bit is to think, well, okay, what is that current system, coastal system, ecosystem going to be like in 15 or 20 years or 25 years if we don't do anything, right? So to kind of go back to what I said before, it's been changing and we know it's going to continue to change.
You know,
what we're looking at right now is what the current state is.
I know some family that owns a grocery store, and they recently expanded, and they put it to me as, you know, we took a shot because we can either die quickly or die slowly if they don't do something to change it. And it seems as though that's pretty much what you're describing, but what I'm saying is a much more simplistic level than that.
No, we're on the same page.
All right, we take a break, come back, more with Clint Wilson. A professor of civil and environmental engineering, director of the LSU Center for River Studies. I'm getting some questions here. If you have any questions or comments or concerns about diversions and the effect, both positive and negative, text them to 87870. I will be more than happy to pass them along to the professor. A lot going on in Washington. If you've ever been to the statuary in the Capitol, that's where a lot of the action is happening today, where they're walking through it to deliver the articles of impeachment from the House to the Senate. Here's an update from CBS with more on WWL. 9:38:22 before 10. Tommy Tucker talking about river diversions with Clint Wilson, professor of civil and environmental engineering and director of the LSU Center for River Studies. Before I get to the questions via text, professor, so I understand this model that you have, it can basically show you what 50 years of this diversion or that diversion would result in what amount of time?
Yeah, so, yeah, let me back up and make sure we're clear that when we say what, you know, 50 years into the future, we're really studying what the river, what's happening on the river side. The because of the scale of the model, because of the, again, the physics of, you know, the water flow, sediment flow, we're not necessarily able to say this is exactly how much land we'll build.
Right.
What we're really looking at is how what's happening on the river side in terms of the way that's the river flows, the water levels, the way that sand moves, and how we can best get that out of the river. So to get back to your question, though, we can. And again, this was actually a fairly long process that we went through technically, scientifically, to demonstrate that we can reproduce 1 year on the Mississippi River in approximately 1 hour in the model. So,
wow.
You know, roughly 5 days is on the order of, you know, 12 seconds, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so that's what we do. Yeah, so we're able to reproduce that 1 year in about 1 hour. So that's why we can do 50 years. You know, it doesn't take us, you know, months and months. We can basically do that in several weeks.
All right, so you mentioned two diversions earlier, right?
Correct.
Tell me about those, where they are, because, you know, I think it's interesting for people that maybe live downtown. They don't understand all of this that's going on, but it can affect them in a very real way.
Right, yeah. So Mid-Barataria River Sediment Diversion is located, I guess, probably about 35 miles downriver from New Orleans, and then the Mid-Breton River, and that would be on the west bank. And then the Mid-Breton River sediment diversion is located about 10 miles north of that, so roughly about 25 miles downriver from New Orleans, and that's on the east bank of the river.
And these are areas that otherwise, but for levees, the river would not be there. And did you take down levees or for whatever reason open levees to get the diversion there? Is that what's going on?
Well, yeah. So it's a fairly lengthy process. So the state went through and you know, a number of studies. I think the Corps of Engineers has been doing studies over the last probably almost 20 years. And we actually did some early experiments with our original physical model to help kind of locate where those would be. And so the plan is, you know, in the state's got some large engineering teams looking at the design of these structures, how to design and construct them. And the idea is to basically replace portions of the levee with large gated structures that would basically, if those gates are closed, then that those structures are acting just like the river levees are today. But when the river, you know, starts to, the flow rates start to get up, the water levels get higher, and the sand starts to move down the river, because we have to understand that the sand doesn't move downriver all the time. It moves, you know, kind of when the river gets more towards kind of medium to higher flow rates. So, you know, the idea is, you know, you open up these gated structures when that sand starts to move, and there's sand up in the river water. So when you open it, you're getting that, not just the river water, but you're getting the sand. I mean, you're really trying to maximize the delivery of sand out into those wetlands. And I think the third part of this, I guess third part maybe, is, you know, there's also a fairly rigorous environmental impact studies that are being done, you know, for permitting through the Corps of Engineers. So a lot of the questions around the design, the operation, you know, replacing river levees, what's the impact on the ecosystem, the economics, all of those are, or a lot of those are covered in the permitting process.
So I get a text here. It says, latest media release heralding the Mid-Barataria diversion project, I guess, produced 47 square miles of land, will produce 47 square miles of land. In 50 years, we lose 30 to 40 square miles per year. So is that really a realistic solution?
Well, I think if you look at the State Coastal Master Plan and thinking about, you know, it's not just restoration. What the state really is looking at doing is either maintaining, you know, or building new land. And I think the maintenance part, you know, maintaining land is just as critical, just because of the, I'm going to say this, the stress on the system, right? The rising sea level, the sinking land. And so, you know, the state's gone through a fairly rigorous, very rigorous process since the first Coastal Master Plan was developed in 2007 to identify where are the locations where we can basically get the biggest bang for our buck. And so, yes, while you might say, you know, okay, that's 50 square miles over, you know, 50 years, roughly, you know, 47, 50 square miles over 50 years. Yes, but that's, you know, those locations are either critical in terms of habitat, they're, you know, critical for at least reducing some of the impact from, you know, southerly winds and maybe mild, moderate storms. You know, but you also can't, you know, I think the state has recognized you can't stop land loss throughout the, you know, the southeastern, you know, part of the coastal part of the state. So, you know, strategically, you have to look at where can we get the biggest bang for our buck, and I think that's where these river sediment diversions come in.
You know, somebody else texted in, and I understand physics. Excuse me, actually, I don't understand physics at all, but I understand that that's involved in it. But at what point, and somebody texted in, and it's not just economic, it's a cultural issue as well in terms of seafood industry. Do you take the effects of the seafood industry into consideration when you do this modeling, or is it all about physics, land, elevations, et cetera? If I'm phrasing that in a dumb way, Professor, but I think you know what I mean.
Oh, no, I know exactly what you mean. And I think, you know, that's where, you know, I think that the Center for River Studies and really the CPRA leadership and et cetera, you know, we've tried to pull all of those things together when we, you know, when we collaboratively, you know, came up with this idea, you know, this concept for the Center for River Studies. So let me go back and, you know, kind of finish that thought, in that we want to have a defendable model. And, you know, to have a defendable scientific tool, you know, you have to be very clear with what you're studying with that physical model. And that is the river, the way the sand moves, how can we optimize, you know, how can we better understand how that sand moves, where it moves, how fast does it replenish certain areas. So the answer is, I guess, first part of the answer is no, with the physical model, we're not taking that into account, because we can't reproduce the salinity levels or the way nutrients are flow from the river out into those habitats, right, the fisheries areas. So that is, you know, we can't do that with the model. But I think at the center, you know, what we do, and, you know, again, with the state and others, is showcase and talk about other modeling results or other studies, and not just scientific studies, but really, you know, I guess you think about culture, you think about the risk perhaps to people in terms of flooding. We think about, how the salinities, how the nutrients are going to impact those ecosystems, and then you carry that through to the economic side and the cultural side. So I guess the bottom line is we're trying at the center to make sure we have a tool that helps answer or address one part of the question, but we realize that we've got to collaborate, and we do collaborate regularly with lots of other groups, not just scientists and engineers.
So basically, this modeling, this projection, it's like, okay, here's part of the information that you need. This will happen if we won't happen if we don't. And then you bring that to the table along with the seafood people, et cetera, and then somehow you try to come up with a conclusion or decision.
Well, that's right. Yeah. And I think that's exactly what the state is looking to do. And when I say this, we partner with, lots of other researchers at LSU and other universities and colleges around the state, and entities like the Water Institute of the Gulf, the Corps of Engineers, United States Geological Survey. But I think more importantly, what we're trying to do is this is the way I was going to say it. We love also having people, and the way the center has been designed is we love having people come out to the center to not just see what we're doing with the physical model, but to really understand all the issues around the river and our coastal system. So to me, there's absolutely nothing, almost nothing better than to sit there and look down at the river with one of our, riverboat pilots, right, who are guiding ships up and down the lower river every day, right, mm-hmm. and to talk to them about what they see in terms of the way the river behaves and what we're seeing in terms of our model, or to have oyster fishermen come out and to talk to them about what we're doing with the model and to help them understand what the piece that we are working on. But also, it's really critical for us to hear back from them in terms of what their concerns are and what they see as the impacts, just so that we can also then better educate, and perform the outreach that we're doing. I hope that makes sense.
It does. As it relates to dredging, as I understand it, I don't know if it's all three passes at the river, but there is constant dredging there, right, to keep the channel deep enough for ships coming in and going out?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, so Southwest Pass for sure, and then about 10 miles, 10 to 15 miles up from head of passes, is dredged on a pretty regular basis, through contracts that the Corps of Engineers lets out, as well as the Corps does some dredging themselves.
And where
that's where most of the dredging occurs.
Where does the material go, Professor?
Well, until probably 10 years ago, 15 years ago, all of that was basically being put in disposal areas out in the Gulf, just outside of Southwest Pass, or perhaps in some of the other passes in the area. But really, in the last 10 years, the navigation industry has worked really, really hard with the Corps of Engineers to bolster the beneficial use of sediments projects. And so what I'm talking about there is now, whether it's through more creative contracting mechanisms, increased funding, partnerships between the Corps of Engineers and, let's say, Plaquemines Parish or the state, where additional funds can be used so that dredged material isn't just taken in the cheapest way off the coast, to be disposed of or dumped into the Gulf, but to be dredged and then actually pumped out in the wetlands. So Sean Duffy's got some with the, I think it's the Great River Coalition, Big River Coalition. They've got some great numbers and kind of data to show the amount of land that reached in the last 10 years has been built through these efforts.
Would that material, is there any way to separate the material? How can I phrase this? And again, it's probably be a dumb question.
No.
But so as not to affect the salinity of the water where you're dumping it, or would it just be all intermixed and there's no way to do that? Would it be another diversion, I guess, what I'm asking?
Oh, you mean when you dredge and pump the material?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, well, you're putting a lot. First off, most of the projects are in a much more defined space when they're doing this pumping and dredging. And I think second is that they're doing it for a fairly short period of time with a lot less river water than is going to be done with the river sediment diversions,
mm-hmm.
If that makes sense.
It does.
So, you know, you're not, you know, with the river sediment diversions, talking about opening those for, you know, at least a couple weeks, if not a little longer. So that's a lot of water that's going out with the sediment, but you're using the power of the river. Whereas with the dredging and the pumping, you know, you've got a kind of I don't say one time, you've got multiple one time projects, right? Where they're dredging,
continuous,
then they're pumping, and that's right. Well, but those are not as continuous. I mean, there's multiple ones. There are multiple times when they dredge when they're doing that. So, but it's not like one dredge is sitting out there all the time, dredging and pumping it over there continuously, you know, for months and years.
Professor, we got to run. I'm out of time.
Okay, no
but
problem.
It would seem to me that is a tremendous amount of very valuable material that somehow could be reclaimed. Accurate or not?
That is accurate. And that's exactly what the state and the Corps and et cetera, we're all trying to do help do.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate your time. 9:52, we're going to take a break. We got to have that man back so we can talk some more about diversions. We will be back in a flash here on WWL.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.